Understood. Thank you. Your Honors, this court illustrates the competing plans that are at issue in this case, illustrate how Chapter 11 can be used either for the purpose of giving a viable small business the breathing room that it needs to thrive and to successfully repay all of its creditors, or alternatively, how it can be used to serve the self-interested motives of opportunists at the expense of a business built through decades of hard work and perseverance. The plan that the debtor proposed in this case would have allowed it to complete the remarkable success that it achieved during the bankruptcy case in significantly paying down its debt. Its plan would have, in fact, paid all creditors with allowed claims in full very shortly after confirmation of the plan. It was indisputably feasible, and it would have maximized the value of the estate, and it would have allowed the equity holders in this solvent bankruptcy case to retain the estate's most valuable asset.
Can I break in for a second? This is Judge Lafferty. You can certainly spend your time any way you like, and I read with interest what you had to say about the importance of the plan to your client, your plan. But I think, we only have a limited amount of time here, and to me, I'm not so sure what it would mean to stay the denial of confirmation. And if in any event the judge had discretion to approve one plan but not the other, it might be better to spend the time on, not so much what's wrong with the denial. I'm not sure what do you mean to stay that, but what was wrong with confirming the other plan. It's totally up to you, but that's just a suggestion.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I appreciate the suggestion. So let me start with the court's confirmation of the Cinco plan. And let me also first note that I've lost the courtroom clock. So I guess I'm just going to do my best to keep time based on the little time in the corner that I have on my screen.
Let me ask Millie and Richard to try it, because I've lost it too. See if you can get that back up. It shows.
Richard is working on it right now on the clock.
Thank you. All right. Keep going, Mr. Pack, because I don't know either. Millie, you'll have to tell us. Please tell him when he gets at 5 minutes.
I will.
So, Your Honor, with respect to the court's confirmation of the Cinco plan, it erred as a matter of law in confirming that plan because it was based upon a non-consensual unilateral release of a non-creditor third-party borrower of the debtor without any consent of the debtor, without any type of arm's-length negotiation whatsoever. And it was proposed by a party that had absolutely no incentive or motivation to maximize the recovery to the bankruptcy estate, but in fact had the exact opposite motivation, which was to minimize the estate.
Can I interrupt for a quick question, just to make sure I understand where you're going? Are you telling us that as a matter of law, the court couldn't have approved that, or that she wrongfully balanced some factors that she was supposed to be looking at?
Well, I think it's both, Your Honor. First, as a matter of law, the court relied on Section 1123B3 to say, well, this is acceptable because the code says that a plan can include a settlement of a claim of the estate. But what you had in this case is not a settlement. A settlement presumes an actual agreement between the parties to be bound by it. And that is not what you have here. What you have is Cinco unilaterally dictating the terms of its own release. So that is not acceptable under the bankruptcy code because it's not a settlement. The bankruptcy court relied on the Ninth Circuit's decision in ANC Properties to analyze it under that four-factor test. But I think what's important here is that the threshold that the Ninth Circuit laid out in ANC, before you even get to that four factors, is that there must be more than a mere good faith negotiation of settlement by the trustee. So what that means is that at a baseline, in order for something to be an acceptable settlement, there must be a negotiation in good faith by some representative of the estate who's actually got a fiduciary duty to maximize the value. If you don't have that, you don't even get to the four-factor test.
Go ahead, Ms. Judge Brand.
I was going to say, didn't she go through an exhaustive analysis to determine whether or not it satisfied the ANC factors?
Well, what she did go through the analysis in ANC that looks at those four factors. Is it fair and reasonable? What would be the difficulties in collection? And I will address why I don't think that the court correctly analyzed those factors. However, I think what the court did not do is decide, is this really a settlement that is permitted by the bankruptcy code? What she held is that in Rule 9019, it says that only a trustee or a debtor in possession can propose a settlement, but the rules have to take a backseat to the code. And I think what she was referring to is, well, 1123B3 says you can propose a settlement in a plan.
It says a settlement or adjustment. Could this be an adjustment?
I don't really quite understand what the distinction is between those terms, but I've looked them up in Black's Law Dictionary and every other type of dictionary. And to me, those terms are essentially equivalent, except that perhaps adjustment has a specific meaning in the context of an insurance claim, which you do not have here.
Okay.
So I think settlement and adjustment for these purposes are essentially the same.
Can I anticipating where I think you're going here, the Whispering Pines case, which I think you cite for some support for this argument, I mean, didn't that case in fact say it wasn't so much that a settlement couldn't be done without the debtor or the trustee, as much as it was that the court there did no analysis and apparently gave a deference that might have been appropriate for a trustee or debtor in possession as an estate representative to somebody who was not one. So I understand why you might think that's supportive of your position, but doesn't that at least imply that this could be a settlement even if it weren't the trustee, and the court's job is to analyze the factors, which did not happen in Whispering Pines? There simply wasn't any analysis of the fairness. I mean, doesn't that imply that this is doable?
Under the First Circuit BAP's opinion in Whispering Pines, I think perhaps there's at least some implication there.
Yeah, I thought so too.
That if there was an analysis under a more strict level of scrutiny,
right,
then perhaps that would be permissible. But I also think that's inconsistent with this panel's precedent in Guy F. Atkinson, because what this panel held in that case is if you want to have a settlement that's proposed by somebody other than a trustee or a debtor in possession, you've got to meet a minimum of two requirements. Number one, there has to be a sufficient reason to allow somebody other than an estate fiduciary to pursue a settlement. For example, that the debtor doesn't pursue it itself, it doesn't have any incentive or motivation to pursue it. And two, that the person who is pursuing that settlement on the estate's behalf has to have a sufficient motivation and incentive to maximize the recovery. And neither of those things are present in this case. Here, clearly, you have a debtor who is very motivated to pursue collection on this claim. During the course of the bankruptcy case, it collected on its note by agreeing to the sales of some of these properties and partially releasing its deed of trust so it could get the payments. It actually filed an adversary complaint on that promissory note. So you have a debtor that is incentivized and willing to pursue its claims, so you don't have any sufficient reason to give somebody else a basis to settle that claim.
It's kind of a warped view, because yes, they're incentivized to litigate this to the death, and there's definitely a sense that the judge doesn't think your client is going to appropriately litigate, your client, you know, is going to appropriately litigate that. So how does that factor into this argument you're making?
Your Honor, I respectfully, I don't think that, you know, whether the debtor is going to litigate it to the death is really a factor in this analysis for a couple of reasons. One, under our plan, the debtor wouldn't really have any ability to expend unlimited amount of money on this litigation. We put the controls on setting litigation budgets and using estate funds in the hands of an independent, professionally licensed fiduciary. So the debtor wouldn't even have the ability to just spend whatever it wants pursuing this claim, which would essentially...
But the debtor's principal had control over settlement.
The debtor's principal had the ability to oppose a settlement or to not ratify a settlement that was entered into by the manager if it didn't exceed certain thresholds. But the debtor did not have the ability to control how much is being spent on that litigation if there isn't a settlement, which forces reasonability in the amount of money that it expends. But two, I want to address a second factor as well. There certainly is no incentive here on the part of Cinco to maximize the recovery to the bankruptcy estate. It's the one that is going to have to be paying out money to the debtor in order to get this claim settled. Its incentive is to pay as little as possible, and that's exactly what it did. That the settlement payment that Cinco is making is the absolute minimum that it would have to pay if it had achieved absolute, complete, unconditional success on its argument that its unambiguous written agreement to pay interest at prime plus 1% actually means it pays no interest at all. That the settlement payment it makes would be assuming that no interest had ever accrued on this loan in the nearly 13 years since it had been extended,
It also argued that this was really meant to be equity after a certain time, right? So they could have argued for a discount on that basis, couldn't they?
That's what they argued, but I think that's...
No, I understand. I know you don't agree with them. Yeah.
Right. You're at your 3 minutes. Do you want to reserve the rest of your time? You're actually past it.
Right. I will reserve the rest of my time, and then I'll talk about the irreparable injury as well.
Good, because you should. All right, Mr. Charles.
So to avoid background noise, I unmute. Your Honor, also on the phone with us is Chris McDonough, who represents a party who filed a joinder in the opposition to the stay pending appeal. And Mr. McDonough has asked me to reserve a minute for him. I will endeavor to do so.
Okay. It's your job, not ours.
Understood. We represent Cinco Soldados. I'm Robert Charles, Lewis Roca, Rothgerber Christie. Appreciate the opportunity to have this argument, and I guess I want to waste some time and say thank you for having a judicial proceeding on a day like this. You know, there is insanity in other places, and to have courts functioning is literally something every lawyer on this call would tell you is a blessing. With respect to irreparable injury, unless you have questions, I'm not going to augment our papers, and in particular because Mr. Pack hasn't talked about that issue. But it seems to me that both Judge Winery did a better job of explaining our position than I did, and our papers explain our position. With respect to success in the merits, I agree with Judge Lafferty. We're talking about confirmation of the Cinco plan, and let me simply focus on the argument that counsel for Skyline makes. He says, and there is no case that says this, the meaning of 1123B3, settlement or adjustment, in the context of a creditor's plan is no such plan can be approved. There's nothing in 1129 that says that. There's nothing in 1123. You have to rewrite the code somewhere. And obviously, that's not your job. That's not a power that 105 grants. And we've tried to give you some gentle authority for that. And I think that if Judge Winery were on this call, she would have said something almost blurted out in response to one thing Mr. Pack said, which is really not directly on point, but it's amazing. He said, to prove Skyline's willingness to collect this debt, it filed an adversary. Well, what's entertaining about that statement is it's not true. To prove that Skyline is serious about collecting the debt, it filed a state court foreclosure action about 30 days after Mr. Zarifi told Judge Winery he would not foreclose the loan. And that's one of the points Judge Winery makes in her opinion as adding to the litany of reasons why Mr. Zarifi is not any involvement of him, any control of him. As the sole member of an LLC that has a manager, tell me how under any state law a manager can act disregarding the directions of the sole member was simply not in the best interest of creditors. But to go back to the point about settlement, it is true that you can read the First Circuit BAP opinion in Whispering Pines and say they think that a settlement offered by a creditor should be treated differently. And they say, we really don't know how, and good luck bankruptcy court figuring it out. And I would say respectfully, that's the position that Mr. Pack has put Judge Winery in. This issue comes up in his closing brief. There's no suggestion of a standard in the brief or before this panel, and there is none in the case law. No case has ever looked at Whispering Pines and said, what that means is a settlement proposed by a creditor's plan can never be approved because the creditor is self-interested, which they always are. And having lived through the Great Recession, I don't mean to cut you off, Judge Lafferty, I can see a question. So I say just, well, here's my question, and I stop. But having lived through the Great Recession, every time a secured creditor proposes a liquidating plan, which is incredibly familiar, we'll take back the property, we'll pay the unsecureds, and we'll go home, and you won't sue us. That's a creditor's plan with a release that Mr. Pack would tell you cannot be confirmed as a matter of law because it's not negotiated with the estate. And if that were the law, one would think that by now we'd see some authority for that proposition. If you go searching, though, in this area and you look at this panel or the Ninth Circuit on fair and equitable, you get a hint of maybe a way to think about this issue in sale cases. The defendant in an adversary or on a claim says, hey, I've got a great idea. Let me buy the cause of action for cheap, and I'll make it go away, and that'll solve the problem. And when you look at those cases and you look at BAP opinions, you'll see where courts do that without going through the fair and equitable analysis, there's a deep concern because you're shortcutting process. Here, as Judge Brand noted, Judge Winery went through the fair and equitable analysis. She didn't stop at any of the elements of 1129, or she incorporated fair and equitable through the requirements of the code, but she went through fair and equitable, and not in a cursory way, but in a detailed, comprehensive, factual way. And to go to Judge Lafferty's point, I wouldn't be surprised if she thinks, but we'll never know, that Mr. Zarifi will never settle this issue because he cannot. It's just not in his nature to ever give up anything. But her recitation of the factual background, this is not a parole evidence case where a day or a month or a few months after documents are signed, someone says, aha, this document is wrong, and you lose because the parole evidence statute of frauds or integration clause. In the notes made in July of 2006, January 2007, we need $500,000. There's no money anywhere. It's a raw land deal. It's not even platted yet. Partners have to put up the money. And Judge Winery recounts that what happened is Chris Schief, the principal of Cinco, the managing member of Cinco, he's one of the two members, Mr. Zarifi is the other, his interest is unchanged, says, I'll put up $1,666,667. I've talked to the bank. That'll buy us at least a year's worth of curtailment payments from the bank. And the partners say yes. Cinco doesn't have a bill from Skyline for interest, doesn't have a demand from Skyline for interest, but the note is interest monthly payable, so there's been no payments. The note's already in default. And Mr. Zarifi doesn't say, excuse me, I object, where's my interest? And Judge Winery's opinion explains why. Because he's on the bank guarantee for $3.6 million. He's agreed among the members he'll pay a quarter of the bank debt, 25%. And he's even guaranteed the $4 million debt that's owed to Skyline. So Mr. Zarifi intentionally decides then and through 2014, give or take, when the bank loan is finally paid off, Schief, I want your money. We're not going to send you bills about interest. We're not going to default the loan. When it matures in 2008, we're not going to say anything about that. When the six-year Arizona statute of limitations comes up in 2014, then we'll do a modification that says there's an issue and that's not being resolved by extending the maturity date. But the course of conduct, the course of dealing, and the performance suggest there was an oral agreement to modify the interest provision, and if there wasn't, that Skyline is stopped from asserting interest, having induced, literally, Mr. Schief testifies without controversy, I've put up $6.8 million into this deal. You know, if Sarifi says in December of 2006, hello, there's interest owed on this note, which, by the way, there's no money to pay, so you need to come out of your pocket to pay that, then Schief can say, well, excuse me, but my guarantee of the bank debt is less than the $1,666,000. Thanks and good luck, gentlemen. He could even buy the bank debt for less than he's put into this deal today. So the notion that Judge Winery probably erred in finding that there was a reasonable probability of success on litigation over this note is just nonsense.
Let me ask you a couple of...
Go ahead.
I have a gating question or two for you.
Please, I'll shut up.
I'm not asking you to shut up, believe me. You know, there's a concern, I think, that I think was expressed at some point by Mr. Pack, sort of a how did we get here? You're giving me a wonderful explanation for what Judge Winery did, which I agree was impressive and complex. But I think the question comes up of there was a claim by your client, and in some way, I guess this resolves an objection to the claim. And I'm not sure how else this was teed up in a bankruptcy sense. I'm not suggesting this is exactly, you know, commercial Western finance where you just decide, well, this is a preference, so we'll just put it over here. But how did this, in your mind, how did this get teed up? Is it just we decided to compromise something in a plan confirmation? Or was it otherwise teed up in a way that would have given Mr. Pack and the other side the chance fully to litigate it?
Well, we've had days of evidentiary hearings, so I don't
know I understand.
How litigation could have happened. After Skyline filed its plan and it, I'm sorry, filed this petition and offered a plan, the plan was a classic debtor stretch out, offer as little as I can, cash flow payments for as long a period of time as possible. And Cinco said, we have a claim. We'd like you to terminate exclusivity and let us file a plan. Judge Winery said, yes, file your plan. And the full payment plan that you see from Cinco today is essentially the plan that was filed back then. So how we get there from here is Skyline has spent the next number of more than a year, maybe close to 2 years, trying to incrementally increase their offer to make it look like what Mr. Sarifi was interested in doing is reorganizing a small business in a way that saves an investment. And that's, of course, not at all what you understand when you read Judge Winery's opinion. So what we get here because a competing plan was filed that said, instead of stretching out creditors for a long period of time, we'll pay this amount, it's a compromise, and we'll pay it now in a way that causes all the creditors to be paid in full
right now,
with money in his pocket.
Mm-hmm. I think we get that, and that is that is an important feature here. I want to go back to something you said. You know, Judge Winery made extensive findings about the probability of success on this claim, and for want of a better term, but she didn't find that there was no chance of your client losing. She found that there was some chance, a significant chance your client will win, but not 100% chance. And then she, in effect, their argument is, well, she then gave them a victory, a complete, absolute victory. Looking at this, can you sort of, what's your response to that? Because yes, they did pay the interest, but there were other factors. How would you monetize the value of the overall settlement under the plan?
So one of the reasons why she doesn't go through to the end is then you just try the case. And so that's why I think you have to get an estimate. But as to the argument that Cinco gets everything it could have possibly gotten, that is not true. The note has never been paid on any basis other than through lot sales. And if you look at any reasonable trajectory for selling lots, that's going to take years. So instead of cash up front today, you get time value of money concerns. The second thing that you
would
give up
for the judge, or is that just an abstract concept that was in the background?
There is no factual determination by the court, but it is also true that if you look at the history of payment evidence provided to the judge, it is clear there were no payments on the note until after the bank loan was paid and there were funds available for lot sales. There never have been. So to say, as Skyline certainly does, the thing is all due now to us is contradicted by the course of dealing. Second, Cinco has been incurring legal fees in this fight for years, and they are not insignificant. We've asked for a fraction of them to be reimbursed under a substantial contribution theory. Those are waived. So in our view, those are at least two materially better outcomes for the estate than, and the third obviously is from Judge Lafferty's question, this should have been converted to equity. And we think we have a good argument there. Sheaf might individually have a restitution claim, but those things go away. We pay right now in full the balance so creditors can be paid in full.
Is the cost of the litigation on behalf of the debtor that is, okay, it's settled, the debtor no longer has to expend funds, is that also a benefit that should be calculated?
Certainly that was Judge Winery's view, but your question was, what about the benefits to Cinco? So I agree with you.
Well, Cinco's deferring expenses.
Not incurring. And not recovering prior investment. In honor of my commitment to Mr. McDonough, I'd ask if you have any other questions, and if not, I'd cede him the balance of the time.
All right. Judge Lafferty, Judge Brand?
Thank you.
All right.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Just very briefly, I'm Chris McDonough. I represent Pequeno's Properties, LLC, which is the largest secured creditor in the bankruptcy. I believe all creditors are in the same position as my client, that they do not want any further delay. Further delay will damage them, cause further damage. It's already been almost 3 years that this case has been pending, and we don't know through the course of the appeal how much longer that would last. And so the panel's being asked to grant an extraordinary remedy with the stay. That's a matter of equity. We believe it will be inequitable to impose further harm on the creditors.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Lafferty, Judge Graham, any questions?
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Pack, you have something slightly under 3 minutes left in your allotted time.
I'll try and use it wisely, Your Honor. Before I address irreparable harm, I want to address just two things that Mr. Charles said. First, he said, well, you know, if you take Mr. Pack's argument, you'll never be able to have a secured creditor's plan where they, you know, give up some value in exchange for being able to liquidate the debtor's property. Cinco is not a creditor, so this is not comparable at all. Cinco is a borrower of the debtor, and they're not, what they're doing is simply unilaterally releasing themselves of liability. They're not releasing the estate from liability for a secured claim. So that is not a comparable analogy. Two, you know, with respect to our plan, the debtor's plan is not a, well, we'll wait for as long as possible to pay claims. It is a full payment plan, pay all creditors in full with interest. And now, as of the time of confirmation, there's sufficient funds in the estate to pay everybody very, very quickly, if not immediately on confirmation, then very shortly thereafter. And the manager has a duty under the plan to pay everybody as promptly as there is money available to pay them. With respect to irreparable injury, what we have now is a senior deed of trust on property that secures a debt that's somewhere between $5 to $8 million.
Well, can I stop you there? No, it's capped at five, isn't it, per the court's finding?
Well, the court found that the court found that the value of the property is $5 million. I don't think that caps us because we're, you know, this isn't like we're valuing debtor's secured claim.
As a practical matter, it's sort of frisky to say it's worth eight because what would you collect?
I understood, although I note that Cinco valued the property at $6 million per their appraisal that enabled them to obtain this bank loan. But if their plan gets confirmed, we lose our senior deed of trust. We cannot ever get that back.
Well, can I ask you a question that's bugging me? Are you telling us as a matter of law that's irreparable harm, no matter what you get in return? It's just end of story. Once you lose a lien, that's it? Or should the court have been balancing something? How should we look at that?
I think in a large sense, Your Honor, it is, as a matter of law, irreparable harm because a first priority lien is a constitutionally protected property interest. But as a practical matter, this certainly gives rise to a significant probability of irreparable harm because at best, we're going to be subrogated to a bank lien whose terms have never been disclosed to us. So we have no idea what the terms are. If there's a default on that, they're going to be able to foreclose and wipe us out completely, and we'll get nothing. And as Mr. Charles said, the only way the debtor has ever been paid on its note is through lot sales. So if we are no longer in a first position priority, and there's another bank with a lien on this property, they are going to dictate on what terms lots are going to be released and whether any payment, if anything at all, is going to be paid to Skyline when lots are sold. So as
Mr. Isn't it relevant that the how the loan proceeds were used, though? Isn't there benefit? I mean, I'm having a problem here because it almost seems as though the argument is this big loan went in there and there was no benefit to us from that big loan. And I don't think that's true because it paid creditors, correct, of the debtor.
Well, there may be some, I understand, Your Honor, that there's going to be some benefit in that that money will be used to fund payments to creditors that will relieve us of that responsibility. But there are payments to creditors that are being made that on claims that we haven't agreed to. There are going to be other costs of this loan, including origination fees and other things that we don't even know about. And that aside, no matter what, we are losing the full value of this loan. So even if we may not be able to recover the additional amount of money that we're owed in excess of that $2.7 million that Cinco is going to pay under our plan. And if we lose that first position lien, that's never going to be recovered. So while there may be some benefit, while we may be able to recover some limited portion of the value of our loan, it's going to be far less than the full amount that we are owed.
And there you're owed.
That we argue that we're owed, that at least we should have the ability to litigate that claim to a conclusion.
It will cost you to litigate. Cost you to incur litigation costs. I mean, that's my point, is you're acting like these are really cast in stone, simple equations. And I just see it's really a much more complicated numerical analysis, I think.
You know, Your Honor, I agree that there's no question it would cost some money to litigate this. I estimated it would cost somewhere around $60,000 to litigate. The bankruptcy court kind of dismissed that as, well, that's just speculative. And that's based on my personal knowledge of this case that I've spent, you know, the last 2 years working on, and my knowledge as a litigator. Maybe, am I underestimating it? I don't think so. I think this could be done for that much. But I think in relation to the amount of money that is owed on that debt, the litigation costs are not so substantial that we're receiving a proportional benefit in just receiving this payment without having to expend that money.
But you also you're not accruing interest on any of the other debt that's being paid off. I mean, there's just so many factors.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I would say even the JMPCC case, which talks about, in fairly broad language, about losing a first position lien, is very clear that, you know, the analysis is a balance of the two factors. You know, the irreparable harm is measured against the likelihood of success. So it's not, I mean, as Judge Taylor said, nothing is cast in stone. We have to think about these things in a sort of more flexible way. So what's your thinking about that?
I think that we do have a likelihood of success. So it is not just irreparable harm. I mean, irreparable harm, I think, is very significant.
But in the context of this particular motion, are you really telling us that we should stay this because we should find, after all that analysis, that her 50-50 risk weighting factor is so obviously wrong that a stay is appropriate?
I think a stay is appropriate because there is a very significant risk of irreparable harm and because we have a strong likelihood of success on the merits. I think it's both. I want to address your comments, Judge Taylor, about the fact that we're saving interest here. If the court were to confirm the debtor's plan, we could be saving interest on all of these secured claims because we could pay them in full immediately. So we would be saving interest on that. We would be paying less money under our plan to creditors. So there's no savings to us.
Well, if you get an agreement with them, or if you get, I get it, but I'm just saying and doing the math, it's not, I just don't think it's as, I think you're being too simplistic, I'll be honest.
Your Honor, respectfully, we had an agreement with Mr. McDonough's client that we would pay them $600,000 inclusive of attorney's fees. The Cinco's plan is you'll pay them $600,000 plus all of their attorney's fees. So there is a cost savings there, and we could pay that immediately. They're paying $200,000 to a creditor who's filed a claim that has never been proven valid, that they had previously taken to the Registrar of Contractors and had rejected, which is based on, hey, we've got construction defects on this home, but it's a home that Skyline never built. So they're suing us for construction defects for another builder. That's $200,000 that's going out the door to them without any real analysis of their claim. Your Honor, I think I've gone well above the amount of time.
I can't see the time clock, so that accrues to your benefit because I have no idea. So, but I'm almost certain that you're right. So with that, I want to thank all of the three counsel for appearing here today. As I said, this is an interesting case. It's an interesting plan. Both the plans are interesting. The situation's interesting. The judge has done a tremendous amount of work on this, and we felt that our decision would be I wouldn't say made easier, but that the decisional process would be improved by giving you this opportunity to argue here today. And I will just say I agree with Mr. Charles. It's not a great day in many ways in the march of democracy, but this is the kind of civil proceeding where we meet as citizens of this country in good faith, and we have differences of opinion, and we have some tough questions, and I appreciate all the attorneys answering them with style. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Submission, and we will get back to you as soon as possible.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This session of the Ninth Circuit Bankruptcy Appellate Panel is now adjourned.